I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See, and you are once again at Pop Culture Happy Hour. I am joined here by Trey Graham, an arts editor at NPR.org, Glenn Weldon, our comics blogger and an NPR book critic, and Stephen Thompson, an editor at NPR Music. How's everyone?
Great. Wonderful.
Are we happy?
Fantastic.
It's a good day for a happy hour.
It's really content is. Hour.
That's right.
For everyone.
I'm too content. I have nothing to argue about and thus nothing to say.
Well, I think everyone has a little something to argue about. And what we were going to start off with today was actually the big development in current pop culture, which is Inception.
Oh, which will get the internet on fire.
Absolutely. I think it's safe to say already has. Mm-hmm. Also made a lot of money this weekend. Made about
$62.8
million. $62 million or thereabouts. I have seen Inception. I know, Stephen, you have seen it.
I have.
And I know, Glenn, you have seen it. Trey, you have not seen it.
I have not, because I have been at the Fringe Festival.
Oh.
So what we are going to do is reenact Inception for you, and I will begin. Whoa!
Well, I have
my brain!
I have seen a reenactment online.
Oh, yes.
Short, starring Dora the Explorer.
Yes, I saw that, too.
There's one thing you should know about me. I specialize in a very specific type of exploration. Exploración subconsciente.
You're talking about dreams. Sueños.
Very good!
We like that very much. You can find that on YouTube. It was done by a website called take180.com. So, Stephen, you alluded, I would say, in your reenactment to gunplay.
Yes.
Would you say that you noticed in Inception a decent amount of gunplay?
I think for a movie taking place largely in people's brains, there was a lot more gunfire, thankfully, than occurs in my brain during any given night. I'd like to say sort of upfront about Inception, though, that you sort of have to rate a movie like that somewhat the way you would rate an Olympic high dive, which is to say that the more a movie is trying to do, the more kind of impressed you have to be when it pulls it off in many ways dazzling way. I think there are some serious, serious flaws in this movie, but many of the things that it accomplishes are pretty incredible, and I found that for a 2.5-hour movie, there was absolutely never a point in it in which you're really thinking about the world outside the universe that this movie sets up.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I found it very absorbing. What about you, Glenn?
Well, I mean, what's amazing about this is the way exposition is handled, because you've got so many things to set up, and it's all done off the cuff immediately, and you don't really spend a lot of time being kicked out. In fact, well, you do. I'm going to out-pretentious the entire panel here for a second.
Wow.
That is a challenge.
It is a high degree of difficulty.
Just
move.
Remember where you are.
Okay. I believe it was the writer John Gardner that narrative, he was talking about fiction, but narrative is a vivid and continuous dream, and that it's the author's...
Book critics.
I'm just saying. The creator's job is to make it both vivid, available to the senses, and continuous, so that the record never skips, so you never send the audience just kind of being aware of the thing itself. Vivid is easily done in a movie. You can see it. But continuous, the fact that there are three different layers going on at any given time.
Right.
The genius thing is that these different layers are functioning with their own different time scales.
Mm-hmm.
It's relatively easy to keep track. But it's amazing that this movie is about calling attention to narrative, calling attention to the way these different stories are being told. I thought, for example, in the scene in the cafe that people keep talking about, where they're in the cafe, all of a sudden they say, how did we get here? Because it's the way you feel in dreams.
Well, dreams, they feel real while we're in them, right? It's only when we wake up that we realize something was actually strange. Let me ask you a question. You never really remember the beginning of a dream, do you? You always wind up right in the middle of what's going on.
I guess, yeah.
So how did we end up here?
Well, we just came from the,
Think about it, Ariadne. How did you get here? Where are you right now?
We're dreaming?
You're actually in the middle of the workshop right now, sleeping. This is your first lesson in shared dreaming. Stay calm.
That that's really about how narrative works, because we've all seen the scene where something happens and then there's a cut and then we see people a few hours later and it's just beginning to talk about that thing that just happened to them.
Right.
And you keep thinking, well, what were you doing in the car trip on
right.
the way over?
Right. Right.
What
right.
were you just playing I Spy? What were you actually doing? Why weren't you talking about this thing? So I thought, and I'm still not convinced that it isn't doing this, but I thought this movie was going to be about how we tell stories. I think I need to see it again to understand what it's really doing. I have a feeling that some of that is in there.
I think it is in there.
But it's tough to unpack.
I think it is in there.
At least one seeing.
I have definitely heard a couple people comment that it's a movie about the way movies are made and the way that you tell stories visually and the way that you tell stories through, you know, those kinds of devices. Because one thing that's interesting is how many things in it in one sense are familiar,
right.
but in another sense are not familiar. Like, you know, one of the few moments that I snapped out of it a little bit, and I agree with you that I mostly didn't, but one of the few moments that I snapped out of it is when it gets a little bit dancing on the ceiling with the with the way gravity works in some cases. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to shoot that stuff so that it doesn't make you think a little bit about dancing on the ceiling.
Right.
And which is a very weird cultural reference to popular head.
It's very hard to get from Inception to dancing on the ceiling.
It's true.
Although if you go by way to Fred Astaire, I don't know. Well, I'm gonna try to trump Glenn on the pretentious front.
If anyone
because I haven't seen the movie.
This is because I haven't seen the movie.
Nevertheless, I still have.
I haven't seen the movie, but I have been talking to Bob Mondello, who's going to be doing a piece coming up this weekend on sort of the history of dream depictions in movies and the power of dreams in movie storytelling. And one of the things we were talking about back and forth is that it's actually much older than movies. The oldest Western narrative we have, at least the oldest Western play we have, The Persians, opens essentially with a scene in which the queen, the empress, Atossa, comes in and disrupts a meeting of the cabinet to say that she's had a horrifying dream about how their empire is going to fall.
Oh,
and it's all downhill from there.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Mm. So. And I think there are certainly plenty of stories where if they're not literally dreams, they're certainly dreamlike. Mm. I mean, anything where you're creating an alternate universe and an alternate way for time to work or things that are visually striking. Very often, even if it's not literally a dream, the senses of dreams, the senses of flights of your imagination, your mind sort of taking off on its own. But one of the things I thought was most interesting about it is that the first bunch of reviews that I read were sort of rapturously excited.
Okay.
And then there started to be this, I don't like to say backlash because I think that implies that it's a reaction to the first, which in many cases I think it wasn't. But to me, it's sort of a perfect movie to demonstrate why I really liked it, I really enjoyed it, despite the fact that I agree with what Stephen was saying, that there are certainly flaws in it. I really enjoyed it. Nevertheless, I think the arguments that have been made by people who didn't like it seem completely valid to
me.
You know?
Well, and I think we should touch a little bit on what those are, because all I really said was there are flaws, and I kind of see them. I didn't necessarily lay out some of what they are. And I think part of it is, I think that the action sequences, the sort of endless ballet of gunfire that barely misses its target, that gets very, especially when it's dreams within dreams within dreams, somewhat pommeling and monotonous. And I did think it was sort of funny that it's supposedly just impossible to plant an idea in someone's head, but you can guard against that with an elaborate security system involving dozens of dudes with machine guns.
Yep.
I can set up dozens of... I can't remember... You know, let's not even get into my dreams. But I did feel like there was a lot of pommeling where it could have used a little bit, and now I'm going to out pretentious everyone by saying that less pummeling, more poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
A little bit more of, the in the film Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind has a lot of very, very memorable scenes in which memories are sort of falling out from under the person.
Yeah, and being scrubbed away.
And
those images are really lyrical.
Right, and they hit you square in the solar plexus.
Absolutely.
Right. And I felt like this film, while it was packed with the sort of imagery that you would see in a trailer, you think about like the trailer for Inception, it's just nothing but like incredible visual. The movie is like that too, but it's not necessarily incredible visuals that tear at your heart the way you'd
Well, again, I haven't seen it, but the thing about Eternal Sunshine certainly is that it has drawn you in and insisted that you feel for those characters
before
it pulls those memories out from under them.
That's important, because one of the digs against this film is that it feels kind of like the way a lot of Christopher Nolan films feel to me, which is sort of mechanical.
Mm-hmm.
It's a thing that you admire, but you don't necessarily love, because it is so intricately wrought out. The architecture of this film, because it has to be, because you've got three or four different storylines going on at the same time, is it really impressive, but the emotional stuff doesn't connect, which is odd because dreams technically are about sort of an emotional through line. That's what connects things
piece to piece,
just that you feel the same way about them, which is why it seems random and weird. It's because the thing that's telling the story is your emotions.
Sure.
And here, because it's so flatly laid out and well planned, it feels kind of cold.
And part of that, I think, is related to the fact that they're not real dreams. This is not an effort to emulate what your dreams are like when they're freely made by your subconscious. This is a creation of dreams that is mechanical. It's industrial.
Right.
Literally.
Right.
It's for profit. And so you get a very much more regimented dream system, because there is a plan and an external architecture for the dream that you're having, and it has a purpose for existing, and it has a very linear goal of getting you from point A to point B, which does not exist in the normal wackadoo dreams that you have where you're at your house and then all of a sudden you're at the beach and, you know, whatever bizarre thing may be happening.
Were we going to talk at some point about the fanboy cult and the sort of response to the critics?
Yeah. The other interesting thing about the cycle of reviews on this movie is that something happened that also happened with The Dark Knight, which is once there was a bunch of very positive response, as soon as there got to be any negative response, there's a really overwhelming sort of reaction of very personal offense taking by Christopher Nolan fanboys. In the case of The Dark Knight, it made more sense to me because it seemed to be related to, and I'm not Glenn's over here.
Glenn's over here
thinking that I'm about to pick on comic people. And that's not what I'm saying necessarily, as much as I'm saying I think they have a little bit of a defensive get no respect kind of thing. And when you get something that suddenly gets a lot of respect, then it's very bothersome when somebody challenges that. And I think that's why I would posit that that's why they got so angry about it not getting nominated for Academy Awards, despite the fact that many of them are the same people who would normally tell you the Academy Awards are, you know, ridiculous and don't really count.
Is that your nerd voice?
Yeah.
Oh, we need to work on that.
You would think just through osmosis.
No, if you would like to hear my nerd voice, this is it right now. you know, and it was an interesting reaction to me, because I think it's always really unfortunate when there's this kind of violent reaction of anger to the idea that anyone might feel differently about a movie than you do.
Ebert was writing about this week, and he had a sort of interesting passage in his essay on it, where he was talking about how it's in part a product of this disconnect between people who, on the one hand, don't really understand in their bones that all criticism is subjective and from somebody's point of view, which is why you find people talking about, well, that's not an objective review. You should be dismissed. You're not a proper journalist. And on the other hand, they have their own very singular, very subjective, very personal response to the film. So anything that challenges that is like a personal attack to them. Mm-hmm. And it's that disconnect that I think makes this kind of angry response possible.
You do fuel it if you call people who don't feel the same way that you do delusional.
Yes.
That kind of fuels the fire.
Mr. Edelstein did kind of beg for that hit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We should explain if we're...
We're talking about David Edelstein was one of the people who primarily was in the lead of talking back about the film.
And reviewer for NPR's Fresh Air.
Yes, a reviewer for Fresh Air and for New York Magazine.
New York Magazine. And it was the New York Magazine review that I think was seen first and contains this line about this reference to delusional hype. And it is true that once you, as the person who is dissenting, decide that you're going to call the people in the majority delusional, you sort of invite the people who are going to call you a mindless contrarian, and the cycle goes on and on, and, you know, it becomes sort of pointless. And when I wrote about on the blog, I got one comment where somebody said, well, you know, you have to expect this because when you disagree with someone, you are attacking them. And I just thought, I know there are people who legitimately feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I just don't feel that way at all. And I don't feel that my opinion is being attacked if I say I really like something. I was thinking today about the conversations I had with Bob Mondello about some of the Oscar movies last year, including, I think, we had some conversations about The Blind Side, which I was fairly tolerant of.
And he just really
couldn't stand it. And it wasn't like I felt like Bob doesn't like me. Bob doesn't think I'm smart because Bob thinks that I like this movie, which is dumb.
Right.
It should be noted that Bob actually does think you're dumb.
He said as much to me.
Thank you, Stephen Thompson, for advancing the conversation.
At any rate,
too much of this conversation was not involving me, so it was important that
either you or picking on me. So.
Right. Yeah.
So to me, I just don't feel that personal investment in my opinion being agreed with by other people, and maybe it's because you get to a point where you are willing to blow off other people's opinions. I don't care what you think.
I think too, because you both, in a lot of ways, do the same kind of thing. You respond to pop culture, both of you. Not to keep coming back to the cult of Roger Ebert, one of the other things he said in that essay, he was talking about another writer named Stephen Boone, whose review he had looked at, and he said of Stephen Boone, it doesn't matter whether I agree with him, he helps me see things.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Right.
And that, I think, is what is valuable in reading a cross-section of reviews, of getting familiar with a critic and understanding their tastes.
Exactly.
And understanding how your tastes line up with it.
Well, and also in the case of Inception, understanding the movie, which, as Glenn said earlier, requires a lot of unpacking.
Right.
There's a lot of stuff. We're reading a number of reviews of that movie have sort of started to flesh out why I felt a certain way. And somebody else sort of felt that it was a little sterile and a little hard to emotionally grab onto. Mm-hmm. And somebody else pointed out that Ellen Page is just there to spout exposition. And somebody, and you do kind of like, I feel very strongly that way. That the exposition stuff didn't bother me, but this kind of did. It's part of the purposes of reviewing, which I know we're all very much in
favor. It's always a shame, I think, when people perceive criticism and reviews to be purely, like consumer reports.
Right, thumbs up,
talking
thumbs
about
down.
A washing machine. Yes, you should. No, you shouldn't. And I think the advent of stars and grades and all that stuff has sort of fed into that idea. And that's where you run into problems with these aggregator sites like Rotten Tomatoes and Metacritic and some of those, where I find those very interesting for sort of comparing trends across time and things like that. But as to an individual movie, that to me is just the least useful piece of information if you're trying to learn anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things that you see as a critic is 10% of the stuff you see is amazing. 10% of the stuff you see is lousy. 80% of the time, you are writing a mixed review.
Right.
And that is the toughest kind of review to write, B, the most boring kind of review to read. So I think I see where some of the really hugely enthusiastic Inception reviews came from. People saw it, and it challenged them. Yeah. And I think a lot of these critics are just used to not being challenged.
Yeah.
And I will say that you bring up a really good point about how 80% of everything is mixed review. Boy, when you get into writing about music, that is quintuply true. Mm-hmm. And you pick up music magazines and see, not to go off on too much of a tangent here, but when they are graded on a letter scale or something, it's sort of everything is on a B+ to B- scale. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Every music review in Rolling Stone is on a 3 to 3.5 star scale. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you start to run into this, well, if everything is a B, that's not necessarily a useful,
Then the B itself is not really telling you anything.
Right.
Yeah. So we should probably move along to...
No, I would like to talk about Inception.
My personal favorite, the regrettable television pop quiz.
Mm. Which, could you sing that for
theme song?
Regrettable television pop quiz.
Yay.
Thank you, Thompson.
Successfully executed the pop this time.
We are fantastic. No. So once again, we have clips from some of the summer's more regrettable shows, or in some cases, just regrettable moments from only semi-regrettable shows. It could be. I don't know that there are any of those in this crop, but so hit it, Mike, with our first clip for the group.
There's a lot of tension, man, so thick that you can cut a knife through the air just to get through it.
he was running up to it. Running up to it, almost nailed the dismount, but not quite.
I'll give you a hint. He was running up to it with a gun.
There's a is there a biathlon on TV?
Is that
where your mind goes automatically to the biathlon?
I'm going to buzz in on this one and guess that it is the History Channel reality series Top Shot.
That is correct. Oh, David Thompson. Right.
Not the last reference to the History Channel on today's show.
It is from Top Shot. They were heading out for one of their many shooting challenges, and the tension was whatever he said, so you could just put a knife,
in the air
get through it.
To provide a little bit more background, Top Shot is an elimination, hesitate to say elimination based shooting challenge, but basically they gather 16 of the world's greatest marksmen.
I may be getting
that number wrong. There might be 12.
I think 16 might be right.
They gather a whole bunch of mostly dudes who are mostly very stoic and then gather around and mostly deal with gun safety.
I will say,
it sounds really lively.
Watching a more recent episode, they have gotten more backbitey.
They've gotten cattier.
But the thing is, only one guy gets backbitey at a time, and then the rest of them get all up in arms about honor. Because that's how it is with a bunch of guys who are marksmen. Because
is honor in the marksman world the equivalent of integrity in every other reality
show?
Well,
yes. And there was actually a guy who said of another guy, and I'm going to get the branches of the service wrong, but he said something like, he was in the Navy. He'd never last a day in the Marines.
Oh, wow.
Because, of course, the one guy came from the Navy and the other guy came. Course. So that's the kind of brutal insult
Brutal sass talking.
So is this the structure the same as Top Chef?
It is similar in structure to other competition reality shows. Mm. You have, one person at a time getting kicked off. And the great part is when you nominate someone to go to the challenge where two guys face off and the one is eliminated who shoots worse, the way you nominate people is that you fire your gun through a little piece of wood with their name on it. Oh. So that the people who are nominated are the ones with the most bullet holes through their name.
Wow.
Which is a,
it's a mark of what excellent shots they are, that they never miss.
I hope they dot eyes. That would be awesome.
No, they do it from about 3 feet away to make sure they don't accidentally nominate the wrong person.
I see.
Okay, next clip.
I have no idea why they did not arrest anyone, but what happened to me deserved for people to be arrested. I didn't go there that night to be terrorized and chased through a country club and then have my hair ripped out of my head and be injured and break my shoes.
I know.
What I like about that is the progression of indignity.
Yes.
Hair pulled out, injured, broke my shoes.
Yeah. And broke my shoes.
You want to lead with broke your shoes.
Yeah, and work up to being injured.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I got nothing.
It's a real housewife of some kind?
Yes.
Which one?
New Jersey would be my guy, I believe.
It is Real Housewives of New Jersey.
Yes.
In their famous fight, which actually ultimately resulted in someone paying a fine for simple assault.
But that is not the inimitable fight in which someone yells, "You prostitution whore."
No, that was a previous fight in the first season of that show where a table got knocked over and stuff. This is a new fight.
This is a new fight.
And the assault actually resulted from the pulling of the hair, which the hair puller argued was not an assault because she did not actually grab any part of the woman. She grabbed her weave.
Excellent. Anytime weaves come into play.
So it's not felony assault, then.
It's a weave misdemeanor. I don't know. But yes, apparently, according to published reports, the weave...
which you have read.
The weave puller paid a fine for simple assault.
We were having a discussion at the show around the office, and someone was saying, I haven't seen this season. And I'm like, well, allow me to summarize. I can't believe she didn't call. And that was basically
Is that your
all,
Real Housewives
was,
of New Jersey
that was all
voice?
There. That was all there had been in however many episodes. I'm waiting for my apology.
Yes.
is a key line.
Exactly. All right, next.
One more thing. Whoever I choose, when it's all said and done, will get this diamond ring that I purchased from Jason of Beverly Hills. This is a 7-carat diamond ring set in platinum. It cost me a lot of money. It's the real deal.
I know exactly what that is.
This is the classiest thing ever on television.
It is this horrible bauble. It's designed, I think, somewhat to look like a Super Bowl ring, which the subject of the show has never and will never win.
I see.
All right. Because it is...
Ocho Cinco?
Very good.
There we go.
The show is Ocho Cinco.
The Ultimate Catch.
The Ultimate Catch. Mm-hmm. And it is, I have to say, even for a dating show with celebrities, really, really bothersome. In the sense that it started off with 85 women, yes, in football jerseys on the football field doing drills.
Right. Oh. Including such as hugging. Yes.
Yeah. Right. Well, hugging the tackling dummy to demonstrate what a good hugger you are. And touch your toes so that he can walk up and down and look at you bent over. Yes.
Yeah. There's at one point, one of his sidekicks, either Terrell Owens or Bernard Berrien, says, "Well, she's got height." Which seriously needed to be followed with check her teeth.
Yeah. Oh. Well, and I have to say, even for a dating show of this kind, to bring in Terrell Owens as your advisor,
yes,
just kind of...
When I seek relationship advice, I go to Terrell Owens, who actually is on another reality show right after, not that I spent yesterday watching VH1, called The T.O. Show, which if... Ocho Cinco, The Ultimate Catch, is sort of a lighthearted romp in the
and nobody's stipulating that it is.
And nobody's stipulating this. The T.O. Show is an incredibly depressing psychodrama starring someone who is not entertaining in the least. Yeah. But anyway, the Ocho Cinco dating show, yeah, it's
pretty grim.
One of the things
I found interesting about the Ocho Cinco show is that he has just enough self-awareness to know that these women are not very smart and not very interesting, but he does not have the self-interest or perhaps simply the inclination to not wish to date them anyway. So you can kind of tell as he's sitting around with his buddies, you kind of get this sense of all these guys sitting around being like, oh, man, this is not a crop of geniuses. But then he's like, but I like this one.
So he's 80% there.
Yeah.
He's 85%.
He is Ocho Cinco.
There we go.
Exactly.
He is, I will say, keeping so far, and of course I'm going to be proven wrong, I'm sure, in the next episode, but he is keeping them notably at arm's length.
That is true. He really is. You kind of get
the
feeling
that... It's not like Flavor Flav where he's just diving in.
Oh my God.
You sort of get the feeling that he's not doing the Brett Michaels, you know...
He's not road testing them, as it were.
Exactly. He's not as true.
Before
Steven
this gets
said it. Not
before this gets any worse, I would just like to pull back from that and thank the 500 channel cable universe for making this quiz possible.
Yeah, exactly.
we are not going to run out.
It's true. All right. The last thing that we want to do today is take another round for everybody to talk about something that's making you happy, something that you like right now, something that you're enjoying, and this time let's start with Glenn.
All right, so I would like to start with a thing that makes me happy in theory, mm-hmm, and then I'd like to obsess about it for 45 minutes about why the execution is bad. The thing that makes me happy in theory is that Wonder Woman is getting a new costume. In theory, this needs to happen. She has been wearing the same star-spangled bathing suit for a very long time.
Haven't we all?
Yes, well. The Star Spangled Panties, let's agree, don't make any sense. She needs a nice athletic pant. I think we can all agree that that's a good thing for her. She's got a bustier, as it stands now.
Right.
And for a hero whose whole thing is hand-to-hand combat, this doesn't make any sense. She's got a lasso. When you have a lasso, that means you at least have to raise your arms above your head at some point, and that is a wardrobe malfunction just waiting to happen. So, let's get her in a new costume. Yay. The costume that they have decided to put her in, and we should all acknowledge here that it's temporary. The entire storyline behind this costume is the gods have changed the timeline, and now she's trying to figure out who she is and where she came from. This didn't get a lot of coverage in the mainstream press. They just kind of hit on the fact that it's a costume change.
In the Wonder Woman press.
But yes. in you know, I did my investigation. I did the shoe leather reporting to find out that it's probably going to be...
Just imagine you in a fedora with the word press on
exactly.
the side.
It's a tiara. And so the costume now... It was created by a guy named Jim Lee, who some people who are comic geeks would know. In the 1990s, he was one of the six artists who left Marvel to create Image Comics and was responsible in part for what I call the poochification of comics in the 90s, when things got really extreme and you know, people got busy consistently and thoroughly. And you can tell from this design that he's still kind of trapped in 1995 or so.
Right.
Because you have these pants, which I just discovered, which is why I'm talking about it today. I just discovered over the weekend that they are stirrup pants. They're not just pants. They are stirrup pants. The new top is fine. It's more supportive, I would imagine. This is good. The jacket. Now, my issue with the jacket is not that it makes her look like she's opening for Judy Tenuta at Caroline's in 1992. Because she kind of scrunches it up
Boy,
her arms.
Boy, there's a reference.
I was going to say, it actually makes her look like a Blackheart.
That's right.
It kind of Blackheart.
Right. It's a, because it's a, we should say, it's a leather jacket with the sleeves pushed up.
Sleeves pushed up her arms. And
a little bit
it's
of shoulder
some,
pads going on.
It's got some shoulder pads, got some little applique stars on it, for God's sake. So it's not the jacket itself. It's what the jacket says. Because when I look at a hero, when I look at Wonder Woman in particular, I want to look at her and think, strength. I want to look at her and think, here is a creature created by the gods, hewn, molded from the very clay of Paradise Island. Do you guys know that, by the way, that she's made from clay? Do you guys know that? Are you aware of that?
No, I do now.
Okay. Molded from clay that the gods kind of imbued with life. So she's pottery, basically. She's basically kick-ass pottery. I want to look at her and think, here is a creature that has been imbued with powers to show us the way to truth and justice. I do not want to look at her and think, oh, she's chilly. Oh,
she's been shopping from the Spiegel catalog.
Exactly. All right, do you want some hot tea, hon? Because you'll look a little nippy. I don't want to think that.
Is that Charles Nelson Reilly?
It's my every mom. That's my universal mom. Every mom sounds universal. Like
so Glenn Weldon crossed with mom is Charles
much.
Nelson.
It's really hall.
Anytime we can get Glenn on the topic of what female superheroes are wearing, I find that is, you know, that's always gold.
The only way this could be better is if Tim Gunn was somehow involved in the game.
Exactly.
Well, I wish.
Yeah. Well, maybe he will be.
That'll always be
one of these
days. All right. Trey Graham, how about you?
I'm going to go with Louis Oosthuizen. Anybody? Anybody? He just won the British Open. You didn't think you were going to get sports from me, did you?
Yeah.
He's the relatively unknown South African golfer who just won the British Open.
Fantastic.
Sort of came out of nowhere.
To be
was
fair,
ranked...
golf. I don't know.
Well, golf for
send
me.
Send your angry emails.
Send your angry emails.
Glenn Weldon hates golf.
But you know, I have a little soft spot for golf because I grew up mostly in Augusta, Georgia, home of the Masters.
Sure.
So you know, we were always going to the Augusta National, and so
the
golf
green
was
jacket.
Again. It's true, you know, not so much for me golf as a sport, but golf as a pop culture phenomenon
sure.
that everyone in the city took part in some way. You know, this guy's got a great story. He's from a not very well-off family, you know, farmers in South Africa. And he's from South Africa, for God's sake, which occupies, you know, this country that occupies a big soft spot in the world's collective heart. And, you know, his own story with the ordinary background and the foundation that finds him and gives him this money so he can pursue this golf dream and all of that. But I think mostly what's touched me about it is that business about golf as pop culture. And golf as a pop culture community that really needed a new hero right now,
right.
And they found this guy,
yeah.
And they have, man, have they glommed onto him.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's making me happy. Also, he's kind of adorable. So.
And his name is?
Louis Oosthuizen.
All right, Stephen Thompson.
Well, my, what is making me happy is very much like Wonder Woman's wardrobe. It is a program on the History Channel, as referenced earlier. Called Sliced.
Safety is always a big concern when you're diving into a slice. And I have to thank the good Lord for Bud on that because I'm not very safety oriented. I honestly could care less about the safety aspect because I'm just so energized to get inside of something and to start slicing it open.
All right, what
are they slicing
this?
Into?
This is not supposed to be a bonus round of regrettable television pop
no,
quiz.
No, this is not regrettable at all. This show is awesome. First of all, I want to say how much I love the fact that the host, whose name is John McCalmont, you watch so many of these shows, including Top Shot on the History Channel, in which the show is sort of so bound and determined to showcase that guns are safe.
Mm-hmm.
That you spend a lot of time sort of like, well, you know, check the safety, you know, blah, blah. And this guy actually just stops and says, like, look, I could care less about safety. I just love the slice.
All right,
what
up. What's he slicing?
Okay.
What are they
sliced doing? Sliced involves this guy and his buddy finding different objects that he thinks that he finds interesting and then hacks them open with saws, and that is the entire show. So there was an episode that I watched recently in which they cut open an armored car. And so they sort of bring out this ever larger and more terrifying string of tools with which to do so. They start with like the jaws of life, and then the saw that he refers to, that's 7 inches close to my hand, is to cut open the tires. And so he just hacks open a pool table to see why the cue ball rolls differently than the other
ball. So it's basically a lot like The Bachelorette.
It is a lot like The Bachelorette. And he has this wonderful voice that you would ordinarily be used to sell you jeans.
Sure.
But he just loves the slice.
Well, that's awesome. All right. Well, my thing that I love is not going to come, I don't think, as a giant surprise to anyone, because you would love it too, but not everyone was able to love this quite as much as me. All right, I need a clip too.
Linda, thanks for sharing my recent Old Spice work on National Public Radio. I hope your organization continues to prosper with generous listener donations, just as my body prospers with a generous intake of lean proteins, vegetables, antioxidants, fish oils, compliments, positive energy, and the occasional slice of key lime pie with a sensibly sized scoop of vanilla bean ice cream, served on a warm plate, with a dessert spoon, and a tall glass of homogenized bald eagle milk.
Okay, that is the Old Spice Man, also known as Isaiah Mustafa. Mm-hmm. And Old Spice did this series of 180-some individual YouTube videos directed at individual people, people from blogs, people from Twitter, people who were YouTube commenters, people from some of the major sort of, you know, nerd sites.
Tastemakers. Tastemakers such as our own Linda Holmes.
Tastemakers. And I, much to my shock, woke up one day last week and came into work and discovered that the Old Spice Man had sent me a personal message about how much he appreciated the fact that once in a while on the blog I have mentioned that I appreciate his commercials. And I freely admit that, you know, everyone sort of says, well, you know, it's marketing, you're falling for that, which is true. But if you had gotten one, you would be exactly the same way.
Well, I also think that this is legitimately one of the best
ad
run.
Campaigns.
It's the best conceived, best designed, best executed social media ad campaign I have seen.
What made it great was they were actually funny. They were actually good.
Yeah.
They were individually tailored to the person. They contained good jokes that were being written completely on the fly. Because, you know, because I had spoken about those commercials before, the one that was addressed to me could have been written earlier or anytime. But they were continuing to do them through the day for people who were commenting through the day.
Yeah.
So they were producing them on the spot, on the fly, and it lent it this sort of immediacy where you just kind of, people just hovered over the Old Spice Twitter feed all day.
Right.
And watched for new ones. And he wound up exchanging messages with some famous people.
Alyssa Milano made a video back.
Alyssa Milano made
a
video or
bathroom.
Two back, and he sent her flowers eventually. It was a whole, they just had a great deal of fun with it. It was legitimately funny. It was fun. And even if it had absolutely nothing to do with me, I would still have admired it just as much.
But
I would not have had the opportunity to listen to him say, Linda, about 400 or 500 times.
But you're right to focus on the writing, because there must have been a huge outtake reel for this thing, because these lines are some of the nonest sequiturs you're going to come across. It must have just been impossible for him to kind of go through that for the sheer number he did over the course of the day, because those lines are not easy.
Well, yeah, and reading about it and sort of figuring out who did it and how they did it, it's Wieden and Kennedy's, the ad agency that did it. But what I wanted to know that was not in any of the articles that I read was who wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
What writers did they get? Because to me, having spent as much time around comedy writers as I have in my lifetime, it seemed like the product of a staff of comedy writers,
right.
not seasoned comedy writers who had worked with each other before, and not ad writers.
Yeah. And I felt like at some point those comedy writers need to be brought out into the light of day.
Yeah.
So I have freely admit that it was pretty fun. That brings us to the close of another Pop Culture Happy Hour. I think that's all we have for this week. And thanks, all you guys.
Oh, can you follow us on Twitter, Linda?
Oh, absolutely. You can follow us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog Monkey C at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at...
I dislike Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N.
You can follow Trey at...
Trey Graham.
And you can follow Glenn at...
G.H. Weldon.
G.H. Weldon. And that's about it. And thanks, everybody, for dropping by. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As always. And we'll see you next time.